All right, we'll get started on our last section for today. I want to remind us of just a couple things here. In 22, that final parable, the parable of the wedding feast, it's broken into two parts. What are the parts, Jacob?
Parable of the wedding feast in which?
The parable of the wedding feast is found in Matthew 22. Verses 1 through 14, it's broken into two parts. What's being depicted in the two parts?
First is the Old Testament before Jesus came, because signifying how the servants were the prophets. They were out spreading news of the marriage, which is between Christ and the church.
Okay. So you have the destruction of the Jews pictured in the first half for having rejected the Son and the invitation to the wedding feast. What's happening in the second one, Josiah?
When the guest came without
the wedding garment. Okay, who's he represent?
Those who are called but to obey all the way.
Yeah, this is a non-compliant Christian, so to speak. So you have the judgment of the Jews in the first one, and the judgment of the church in the second one. And it's a progression. It goes from first you have the judgment of the Jews, and then later on, at some point, you're going to have the judgment of the church. Okay? In Matthew 24, verse 1 down through verse 25 is a graphic depiction of the destruction of Jerusalem. In verse 27, he uses that term parousia, the coming phrase there, and he says, the destruction of Jerusalem is not my coming, essentially. This is not my parousia. Don't be deceived. Don't let anybody talk you into thinking it is my parousia. Then, in verse 29 down through verse 35, he's saying you're going to have this shift take place. The Jewish nation passes away. The church age is ushered in all of its glory, and the gospel goes forth fully. And there's great blessings that come through that gospel age. And he says, verse 34, assuredly I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. So you're envisioning this destruction of Jerusalem, rise of the Messianic kingdom, the church. Okay? That's very similar to what's happened in Matthew chapter 22, judgment of the Jews, then the rise of the church and the judgment of the church. I believe that's what we're seeing depicted here now in verse 36 moving forward, is this is the end time judgment, the judgment of the church, the judgment of the whole world, in fact, in the final days. Read for me verse 36. Jacob, read verse 36 for us.
But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only.
Okay. After he says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away, he says, but of that day, okay? The word but there is a transition. It's a conjunction that's used to signal a transition. And he's transitioning now from one subject to the next. In verse 34, notice it says, assuredly I say to you, this generation will by no means take away till these things take place. These things, all these signs, all this that I've described to you, look out for these things. He's spoken of those days, these things. Okay? He goes from talking about these things to that day. From talking about things that you can know to a day that you cannot know about. There's a transition that's taking place here in subjects. He changes, and you need to note, he changes from speaking of a plurality of days to look out for and a plurality of signs to look out for to speaking of a single day without any sign, without any warning. Okay? This is important. He says, but of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angel of heaven, but my Father only. There's going to be a single day, and there's going to be a single moment within that single day. No man knows about. No man can know about. When people start telling you about this day, You know that they're lying to you because they do not know. No man knows. At this time, Jesus didn't even know. Only the Father in heaven knew when this day was going to take place. Nobody knows. Now, if this is speaking of the destruction of Jerusalem, as some claim, why would he start speaking this way? He's given them all kinds of signs. He's spoken to them of the days leading up to destruction, what's going to happen at the end of the destruction, how long it's going to last, all these things he's talked about. And now he's saying, oh, you don't know when it is. You can never know when that is. That doesn't make sense. I think the explanation is that there's a transition taking place here in verse 36. We'll talk more about this as we go along. Look at verse 37. Read verse 37, Josiah.
But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be.
So shall the what?
The coming of the Son of Man be.
The coming of the Son of Man. Where have we read about the coming? Heaven? You read about it in verse 27. What did we learn from it in verse 27? Everybody's going to know about it. It's going to be sudden, visible, universal, glorious, happens one time, and it was not at the destruction of Jerusalem. That's the point of verse 27. The parousia did not happen at the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, Jesus is saying, here's the parousia, the coming of the Son of Man. The parousia did not happen at the destruction of Jerusalem. The parousia, that one time, very quick sudden event, that's what he's talking about now. He's answering the disciples' second question, so you need to pay attention. He's done talking about when will these things be the destruction of Jerusalem, and now he's going to move on to the second question and the third question. The parousia, when is that day going to be? Well, he says nobody knows when that day is going to be. He's contrasting the days of the destruction of Jerusalem. Here's all the signs. The days of the destruction of the world, no sign given to that one. See, I've told you beforehand. Okay? He says that these days, that day, but as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. Now that ought to raise a question in your mind. What about the days of Noah? What happened? What were the days of Noah like? If we can understand the days of Noah, we can understand more about what that day is going to be like. Nehemiah, read for us verse 38.
Days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark.
Okay. Does that sound like the days leading up to the final day of Jerusalem's destruction? People marrying and giving in marriage and eating food and partying and having a good time? Does that look like the picture we just saw of the destruction of Jerusalem? Absolutely not. This is radically different. This is just life as normal. You know, we've been having a good time today. We had a good meal today. My wife had to plan at the beginning of the week how she was going to cook all the meals and what we were going to have for lunch throughout this study. You know, you may be thinking about, well, I got to go to a wedding down the road here. You know, there's going to be a lot of good things coming along. Coincidentally, for what it's worth, you know, Jeremiah never got married. He was a single man all of his life, and God told him not to get married because he was to depict by his very lifestyle impending disaster. He didn't go to weddings and he didn't go to funerals because he's saying we have no time to rejoice or to mourn for people that are dead. We should be mourning about the nation that is dying. There was no feasting and there was no rejoicing and life as usual for Jeremiah. Yet in the days of Noah, everything's going well. No one knew what was going to happen until the day God told them to get into the ark. Not even Noah knew whenever the destruction was coming. Now God told him, get ready, I'm going to destroy the world with the flood. But he never told him the day nor the hour that that was going to take place. Noah just went around for about 100 years and he's preaching, world's going to end. At some point the world's going to end. You better get ready. God's going to send a flood and he's going to destroy this world. So get ready. Repent. Nobody listened. Everybody just goes about business normal. And they think, oh, you know what? God didn't destroy it yesterday and he didn't destroy it last year and he hadn't destroyed the world in the last 99 years. And so it's probably not going to happen today either. But all of a sudden on one day, in one moment, God said, Noah, get in the ark. And God shut the door to the ark, and he destroyed the world in a moment. That is what the end of the world is going to look like. That is not a depiction of the end of the Jerusalem of Israel's empire. Read verse 39 for us, Joseph.
And did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be.
Okay. Who got taken away, Joseph?
The wicked men.
The wicked men were the ones taken. That's important, and you ought to underline the word taken or took, because it's going to be used three times here in just rapid succession. The ones that were taken were the ones who were lost in sin. Okay? So also will the coming of the Son of Man be. What's that word coming there? Josiah?
Parousia.
This is what the parousia is going to be like. When he shows up, it's going to happen one time, it's going to happen sudden, it's going to take everybody by surprise. The wicked are going to be taken in that day. Okay? Verse 40. Read verses 40 and 41.
There shall two be in the field, the one shall be taken and the other left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill, one shall be taken and the other left.
Okay? You got two men working out in the field, normal day. They just went to work like normal. One of them gets taken. Who's getting taken? Who got taken in the last verse? Huh? The evil men. There's two women that are grinding. One gets taken, the other one gets left. Which one of the women got taken? The evil woman got taken. Both men and women will be taken in the judgment that's coming. It's not going to be just based upon gender. Only the righteous are going to remain. It's going to be both individually and personally in that final day. Look at verse 42. Read verse 42.
Or for ye know not what your hour your Lord made, your Lord doth come.
Okay. Watch therefore, pay attention, be ready, because you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. You don't know when the parousia is going to be, so pay attention. Live your life right and be prepared. In other words, don't allow this day to come on you suddenly and be like the man in the field that got taken, or like the woman grinding mill that got taken. A lot of people think that, you know, the most important thing in their life is going to work and making a living. And he's saying, you got your life just on work. You may be taken. Be prepared. Be watching. Be ready. Now you got another warning here. Look at verse 43 through verse 44.
But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect.
Okay, Jesus is picturing himself now as a thief. He's going to come like a thief in the night. Now, who's the one that feels like Jesus would be a thief? The one that's unprepared. What's Jesus robbing from them? What's he stealing from them? Huh? Life? Well, there's a better answer.
Opportunity
to repent. Now, this ain't fair. Jesus robbed us of an opportunity to get ready. If he told us when he was coming, we'd have been ready. And he's saying, look, I told you beforehand, I'm not telling you when I'm coming. You better be ready when I show up, or else you're going to feel like I came and robbed you. Okay? He's coming to take away something. He's coming to take away the opportunity to get ready. Now, I want you to think about three things here. These are three warnings. This is a trilogy. Three sides of the same coin, or the same three pieces of the same puzzle. The first sign, the sign of Noah, is saying Jesus' coming is going to be without signs. There are no signs when Jesus returns. Number two, he's coming in the same manner upon the righteous and the unrighteous. Christians and unbelievers are going to be in the same boat. Neither one of them knows when he's going to arrive. And there's going to be a personal and individual judgment on both Christians and sinners. It's fair. Both are going to be treated the same. And number three, only those who are unprepared are going to suffer the loss. No signs, sudden appearance for both all individuals, and only the unprepared are going to suffer loss. All those who are taken away for destruction. This is a picture of the final judgment day. Okay, that trilogy of warnings is followed now by a trilogy of parables. This is another place where a chapter break is a little bit unfortunate, because this is the same sermon, and you have the first parable presented in verse 45 down through the end of the chapter, and then you have two more parables presented in verse 1 down through verse 30. You may think, well, Nathan, there's four there. There's this, the Son of Man will judge the nations. There's four parables there. Actually, that fourth, what people call the fourth parable, I believe is just a picture being painted. And it's summing up the three parables of the trilogy that has been given. The first parable, remember, this is a trilogy. Each piece represents a piece of the puzzle. But the first parable has the subject, I'm getting ahead of myself here. The subject in all three parables is the church. I think that's important for us to recognize. The subject is the church. Look at chapter 24, verse 45. Read that for us, Mike.
Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season?
Okay, this is about the master making someone ruler over his household. That's the church. The church is what's under consideration. Look at 25, verse 1. Jacob, read that for me.
Of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom.
Okay, so this is a parable about the kingdom of heaven. That's the church again. Notice again, chapter 25, verse 14. What's that say, Josiah?
Well, the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods.
Okay, another parable about the kingdom of heaven. All three of these parables are about the kingdom of heaven. This is about the church. And what's being depicted here is the church, not Israel, the church. Okay? The other thing that all three of these parables have in common is that there is a delayed return. And the delayed return affects the church, either positively or negatively. Usually negatively is what's in light. Look at chapter 24, verse 48, Nehemiah.
That evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming.
Okay, this evil servant, he's got it in his mind, the master delayed his coming. I'm going to have some time to do whatever I want to do. There's a delay that takes place and it affects the servants. Okay, look at chapter 25, verse 5. Joseph?
Well, while the bridegroom delayed, they all slumbered and slept.
Okay, there's some delay taking place and it's affecting the party of the bridegroom. Look at chapter 25, verse 19.
After a long time, the Lord of those servants cometh and reckoneth with them.
After a long time, there's another delay. All three of these parables are about the church, and they're also about how the church has been affected by the delay of the coming of Christ, by the parousia. Okay? The first parable here. The faithful servant and the evil servant. The parable of the faithful and the evil servants. I believe this passage is depicting the church's obligation. Okay, church obligation. Let's read this parable together. Verse 45 through 51. Cody?
And is a faithful and wise servant whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household to give them meat in due season. Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. Verily I say unto you that he shall make him ruler over all his goods. But and if that evil servant shall say in his heart, my Lord delayeth his coming, and shall begin to smite his fellow servants, and to eat and drink with the drunken, the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looketh not for him, and in an hour that he is not aware of, and shall cut him asunder and point him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth.
Okay, think about what's being described here. Christianity is about servitude. God's placed us within the kingdom. He's appointed us as servants within the kingdom. What an awesome privilege that has been. You know, there's been other people who have had the privilege of servitude. Who's that? That's the first Israel. They had an opportunity to serve, and they blew it. They forgot all the blessings and the privileges that came to him as servants. They blew it. And so we've just seen they got destroyed. Now he's talking about the church, and he's saying, we're servants in the church. Take note that you don't blow it as servants and wind up in the same place that Israel was. That's the message he's wanting to get across to us. Notice what it says there in verse 51. And he will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. Now, whoever this is, they're being appointed a position with the hypocrites. They are not the hypocrites. Who are the hypocrites? The Pharisees. Yeah, we just had, woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. 8 times he said that. And he pronounces that curse upon Israel. He's saying, now, if you become a wicked, lazy servant, God's going to do to that servant the same thing he did to the first servants, and he's going to destroy them. This is the church. This is not Israel being depicted in their destruction. One like the hypocrites. They are not the hypocrites. This passage reminds me of Philippians chapter 3, verse 17 through 21. Read that for us. Jared, I think it's your turn. Philippians 3, 17 through 21.
Brethren, join in following my example, and note those who so walk as you have us for a pattern. For many walk, of whom I have told you often, and now tell you even weeping, that they are the enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly and whose glory is in their shame, who set their mind on earthly things. For our citizenship is in heaven, from which we eagerly wait for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform our lowly body that it may be conformed to his glorious body, according to the working by which he is able even to subdue all things to himself.
Okay. Verse 19, whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly, and whose glory is their shame. There's the attitude that some Christians have in life. Everything's about me. They are a Christian because that suits them. They think they can get something out of Christianity. That's exactly what's being described in the parable of the wicked and the evil servant. Now he decides in his heart, the master ain't coming back. You know what? We got plenty of time. Christ hadn't returned in the last 20 years. I've been a Christian for about 20 years now, and he's never come back in my lifetime, and so I've got plenty of time. You know, the end of the world's not yet. It's going to be a long ways off, and so I got plenty of time, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to start beating my fellow servants. I'm going to start using the church for my benefit, and I'm going to get out of people what I want out of it, and if I don't get my way, I'm going to start grabbing people by the neck and choking them out. I am going to have my way. He begins to eat and drink with the drunkards. Fellowship with drunkards and drinking is a sign of one being an evil servant. We got a lot of folks saying, oh, you can drink a little bit, it don't matter. That's the attitude of someone who's thinking about the delay of the coming. He's warning people, the church needs to be concerned about how its members are serving one another. We are servants. We serve the master and we serve one another. And we need to be concerned about both relationships and how we're helping one another rather than trying to have our way and choke out the life that's in the church. Be aware that the Lord is coming back, and one day we're all going to have to stand before God in judgment, individually, and face judgment for how we've treated the kingdom. We have an obligation to work with and to help all of God's children within the church. I think that's something we need to reflect upon. This wicked servant was surprised by the Lord's return. Should he be surprised, Josiah? Should he be shocked when the Lord comes back?
He delayed,
that's right, but should he be surprised that one day he quit delaying?
No.
No, he knew. The Lord told him, I'm coming back one day, and it's his fault for just saying, oh, the Lord ain't coming back. No, the Lord's coming back, and he warned him. There's going to be a lot of people on the day of judgment. And this passage is teaching, in the day of judgment, there are going to be a lot of people in the church that are shocked when the Lord comes back. They're not going to be ready because they had this idea of delay. He has presented a place with the hypocrites. And what's the last phrase there in verse 51? Weeping and gnashing of teeth. What's that talking about? Hell, this is final day judgment destruction. This is not the destruction of Jerusalem. He is judging all people. Okay?
I got a question about that.
Yeah.
Is this weeping and gnashing, do you know
is I've read that the gnashing of teeth means people that are angry and they're like when Stephen was being put to death, those that were stoning him were grinding their teeth in rage toward him. So is this describing people that are in hell and they're angry with God and they're gnashing their teeth in anger, or is it people that are gnashing their teeth in great pain?
I think there's two things being described here. You got some people that are weeping and crying because they knew they blew it and they got what they deserved and they're sad. But you got other people that are gnashing their teeth in anger because
in anger.
That's how I've understood it to be. I think there's two like a double-sided coin being depicted. You got weeping and gnashing of teeth. There's going to be people in judgment that are sad because they knew it. They were a Christian. They were a Christian for 50 years. And the Lord's return surprised them. And they're sad about that. And they're upset with themselves. And they got all eternity to weep about that. And there's going to be others who get angry at God. They were angry at God in this life, and they're angry for all of eternity. All right, so we got the parable of servanthood and obligation to the kingdom. The second parable, the wise and the foolish virgins. Let's read this one together. Whose turn is it? Is it Mike? Read the whole parable down to verse 13.
Then the kingdom of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Now 5 of them were wise and 5 were foolish. Those who were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them, but the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. But while the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept. And at midnight a cry was heard, "Behold, the bridegroom is coming, go out to meet him." Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps, and the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the wise answered, saying, "No, lest there should not be enough for us and you. But go rather to those who sell and buy for yourselves." And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the wedding, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he answered and said, "Assuredly I say to you, I do not know you. Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming."
Okay. There are 10 wise and there are 5 wise and 5 foolish virgins here. Okay? The 5 foolish virgins. Was God unfair with them in his return? No more so than he was with the 10 that were prepared. What made the foolish virgins foolish is that they were not prepared. They had opportunity. They knew, just like the wise ones, that he was coming back. They just chose not to make enough provision for his return. This is depicting the individual obligation of being prepared for the Lord's return. Every individual Christian has to get ready for the arrival of the King. I can't do it for you. You can't do it for me. You can't do it for your kids. My parents can't do it for me. Every single Christian has a personal obligation and responsibility to get ready for the return of the Messiah. He's coming back. He's told everybody. And when he returns, the burden is on us. Are we going to be ready, or are we going to be surprised at his return? You have these 5 foolish virgins. They realize he's getting closer. They think maybe he's getting closer. At least their lamps burn out, and they thought, "I need to go get some more oil before he returns." They're wanting to borrow some from the other people. And the point of the parable is, you don't get to borrow it from anybody. It don't matter if your grandma was a real good woman who served in the church all her life. That was good for her. You don't get to go on her coattails, in other words. It's an individual obligation for preparedness. There's, I think, at least 4 lessons. We could spend a lot of time here. We're not going to do it right now. But there's 4 lessons I want you to take away from at least the big picture. Number one, no one can rely on somebody else's preparedness. You have to do it yourself. You have to get ready. Number two, once the door shuts, as they say on the train, the doors are closing and will not reopen. The door gets shut by the master, and you can stand outside the door all you want, and you can beg and you can scream, but the door is shut and it will not reopen. Number three, this passage, I believe, is echoing Matthew chapter 7, verse 22 and 23. What do we read over there? Jacob, it's your turn. Matthew chapter 7, verse 22 through 23.
He will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, and done many wonders in your name?
Okay, here's some people that say, Lord, Lord, we knew you. These are the five foolish virgins. They can truthfully claim that. Lord, we didn't know you. We were members of the kingdom. We just weren't ready. You kind of caught us unprepared. We weren't ready for your dinner visit. And he's saying, look, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of iniquity. These people have cast out demons in the name of the Lord. Yet he rejects them. And they are counted the same position as people who never obeyed the gospel to begin with. I want to also notice that this is the third time in this little section of verses that Matthew has commanded the people to watch. He's really boring that point home. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming. Here's a little side note I want to make. Neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming. This links verse 13 back to chapter 24, verse 36. The day nor the hour. Verse 36, but of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. Here's the point. If you're going to take verse 36 to be a reference to the destruction of Jerusalem, you got to take verse 13 of chapter 25 to be about the destruction of Jerusalem. You can't go separating these chapters where you want to. You can look at chapter 25 and you start taking the parable of the foolish virgin. That looks like the end of the world. Yeah, pretty clear. The parable of the town. Yeah, that looks like the end of the world. Son of Man judging all the nations. That definitely looks like the end of the world. But now, I want verse 36 to be the destruction of Jerusalem. It don't work like that. He's using language and he's tying it all together. And the picture begins in verse 36 and it goes through 25, whether you like it or not. And what we end up doing is we come up with a theory and then we have to take passages that are clearly talking about the end of the world and we have to shove it through the meat grinder to get it packed in the sausage tube. It don't work. One final thought, and I'll move on, about this parable of the wise and the foolish virgin. This is the depiction to me of Sunday morning Christians. They have enough oil in their lamp to get them there on Sunday morning, but they run out by the time Sunday afternoon service gets there, and they don't have any during the midweek to get there either. They have enough oil supply for one time a week. Where is our oil supply? What is our level of oil supply? And what are we doing? I'll tell you what, it'd be bad enough if people could recognize they were in that state and they were trying to find some more oil. But we got a lot of people that don't even know that they've run out of oil and they're not busy looking for any. They're not doing anything to get ready for the Messiah's return. They're burnt out. And one day they get burnt up. That's the point of the passage. The third parable, the parable of the talents. Dad's talked about this a good bit today, and so we'll keep our remarks brief, but I want us to go ahead and read it through in its entirety. Is it your turn, Josiah? Read it for us, verse 14 all the way down through verse 30.
For the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1. To every man according to his several ability, and straightway took his journey. Then he that had received the 5 talents went and traded with the same, and made them other 5 talents. And likewise he that had received 2, he also gained other 2. But he that had received 1 went and digged in the earth, and hid his Lord's money. After a long time the Lord of those servants cometh, and reckoneth with them. And so he that had received 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents, saying, Lord, thou deliverest unto me 5 talents before. Lord, thou deliverest unto me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained beside them 5 talents more. His Lord said unto him, Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. He also that had received 2 talents came and said, Lord, thou deliverest unto me 2 talents. Behold, I have gained 2 other talents beside them. His Lord said unto him, Well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. Then he which had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew thee that thou art a hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown, and gathering where thou hast not strawed. And I was afraid, and went and hid my talents in the earth. Lo, there thou hast that is thine. His Lord answered and said unto him, Thou wicked and slothful servant, thou knewest that I reap where I sow not, and gather where I have not strawed. Thou oughtest therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received mine own with usury. Take therefore the talent from him, and give it unto him which hath 10 talents. For unto every one that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance, but from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. And cast ye the unprofitable servant into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth.
Okay. I'll point out as a point you need to underline in your Bible, you need to underline the last phrase of verse 30. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. There it's appeared again. You have it here in verse 30. You have it in verse 51 of chapter 24. And you have it over in chapter 22, verse 13, at the end of the parable of the wedding feast. You need to link all three of those together. They're all three talking about the same thing, and it's final day destruction of the people. Now, as Dad pointed out, you have a distribution of talents, which is a piece of money, based on the abilities of mankind. Whenever I hear this taught, I'm like Dad. We say they were given abilities based on their abilities. That's not what's happening here. You have opportunities, I believe, based upon abilities. We all have different abilities. God recognizes that, and he expects more out of some of us than others. He gives us more opportunities. We need to recognize the opportunities that we have and use the abilities for which they were granted to us to further the cause of the kingdom. What you're seeing depicted here in the parable of the talents is evangelism, the need for evangelism in the church, because weeping and gnashing of teeth is coming. And our obligation as the church is to try to save people from that wretched end. What are we doing? How are we using our opportunities? Are we developing our abilities so that we can gain more opportunities? What are we doing? I think a lot of times we sit around kind of like this last man and we think, well, you know, since I'm not a 5-talent man, since I don't have as many opportunities as the man who has a lot of abilities, and so since I don't get as many opportunities and since I don't have as many abilities as him, you know, there's nothing really I have to do in the church. Now, I can understand if I were a Ronnie Wade or a Don King, you know, whoo, them guys, they got lots of talent and they also have lots of opportunities to use that talent. And they better be working. If the church is going to be good, they're going to have to do it. Now, every preacher, every church leader is going to stand before God in judgment. But they're going to have to stand there individually by themselves. And they get judged for what they're doing. And the rest of us, who have lesser talents, lesser opportunity, we still get judged for what we've done with ours. And we need to recognize what is our obligation. Think about it. The story of E.H. Miller. E.H. Miller had a third grade education, from what I'm told. A lot of people looked down upon E.H. Miller, said he was an uneducated man. He could butcher the English language. He didn't have much ability. That man maximized the use of his opportunities that he was given based on his ability. He had debates all over the place. He preached the gospel wherever he went. We were telling stories this week where he got attacked for preaching against Masons. The brethren told him up in Kentucky, don't preach against the Masons, and he preached against the Masons, and they told him he better get out of town. He wasn't afraid to teach the gospel the truth anywhere. And with what people considered a lack of ability, he created tons of opportunities and used them for God's glory. What I find a lot of times happening is we focus on how educated is a person. And we think you got to be really educated and you have to be really smart and you have to be really eloquent if you're going to preach the gospel. And if you're not that, you don't get to preach the gospel to anybody. Nobody's going to listen to you. And we start looking at the world around us and we look at the denominations. They got big wig preachers, big televangelist preachers that can talk smooth things. And we think, if we're going to appeal to the world, we're going to have to get somebody like that. And if we don't get somebody like that, well, you're not going to do any good. That's not the picture that's painted here in the parable of the talents. God expects every single member to be evangelizing. Everybody can evangelize somebody. Mothers can evangelize their children. Grandmothers can evangelize their grandchildren. Everybody has neighbors that they can talk to. Everybody has co-workers that they can talk to. Everybody has a child who has a friend. Hopefully every child has a friend. Talk to that friend. We have family members. We have aunts, uncles, cousins, brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers. We got all kinds of people in our life, a lot of which are not saved. How do we take advantage of the opportunity? We have the mentality of counseling, the counseling profession. I have a degree in counseling, and all through getting my degree, they would pound it in your head, do no harm, do no harm. And who cares if you didn't do much good? I guess they do care about that, but they're more concerned about doing no harm. Be careful, don't do any harm. I think we get that mentality pounded into our heads. And the mentality is, don't offend anybody. Don't run anybody off. Make sure before you present the gospel to someone that you have it packaged up in a perfect package that is irresistible. And if you haven't found that yet, don't say anything about it because you're going to end up running somebody off. Whatever happened to just talking about the Bible to people? Talking to everybody about the Bible and trying to evangelize anybody that's willing to listen. If we want our churches to grow, the kingdom to grow, everybody's going to have to get involved. Not just the work of the evangelist. He has a responsibility in evangelizing. Not just the obligation of the church leaders. It's the obligation of every single member. Personal responsibility in evangelism. And don't miss the point. People think God's delayed. We got more time. I'll get to it next week. I'll get to it next month. I'm going to take this job, and I realize I'm going to be out of commission with this job for a couple years, but one day in the future, I'll get to a spot where I can get back to evangelizing. We have to take advantage of the opportunities as they present themselves. Now I want to recap, and then we'll go into the final section there. You had three warnings in Matthew 24, verse 36 down through 44. What were they? What was the first one, Jacob? Josiah? In Matthew 24, you had three warnings before he starts giving these parables. What was the first analogy he gave? Nehemiah? Look at verse 38 or 37. The days of Noah, it's going to come without a sign. There's your first one. Number two. Sudden and individual, the man working in the field, the woman grinding meal. What's the third one?
The servant. Only the unprepared.
The thief in the night. So you got days of Noah, people grinding and working in the field, the thief in the night. I left this out and I meant to make this point, so I'll give it to you now. They're taken. They're taken. They're taken. Three takens are in this section. Someone says, now, I think the ones taken are the saved. Well, clearly the ones taken in the first one are the wicked. They're the ones in the days of Noah who were taken away by the water. This is not the only occasion, though, in verse 38 or verse 39 where the taken are the wicked. In Matthew chapter 13, verse 41 through 43... you have the parable of the wheat and the tares. And the tares are the one that are taken by the angels in the harvest time. They're taken away for destruction, and coincidentally, there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. The taken is the wicked. So you have this sudden, without a sign. You have this individual and personally. And then you also have this thief in the night, people not being prepared. So there's the three warnings. And he follows up those three warnings with the trilogy of parables. The evil servant. Delay is coming. We are to be servants, serving in the kingdom, serving one another, serving the master, being faithful members of the church. We're going to have to be personally ready for the Lord's return. We can't live off of other people's supply of the gospel and of salvation. We have to be like the 10 wise virgins with trimmed lamps and plenty of oil. And then number three, you have the parable of the talents. We have to be about evangelizing. Every single one of us have to be evangelizing for the Lord's return. If we are not evangelizing, if we are not prepared, if we are not serving in the church, what are we? Verse 26 of Matthew 25. But he answered and said to him, "You wicked and lazy servant." Is that our depiction of people who don't serve in the church? They just show up once a week. People that don't evangelize, they just, you know, they're good folks. And people who aren't really prepared, they're never there around anyway. He calls them wicked and lazy servants. There's more to Christianity, folks, than just gathering one time on the Lord's Day and having one cup and one loaf on the table. Now, I don't know where we've gotten to or how we've gotten there, but it seems like a lot of times that's all that matters. It don't really matter what gets taught. It don't matter who gets involved. All that matters is that once a week we have communion. And I'm not trying to negate in any way communion. But there's more to Christianity than just that. Now in verse 31 through verse 46, we have a picture that is painted of the final day of judgment. We've had three warnings about it. We've had three parables about it. Now we have the big broad picture that's painted. Whose turn to read? Nehemiah, I think people are pointing fingers at you. Read for us 31 down through the end of the chapter.
Son of Man comes in.
Okay, hold it. There's the coming, the parousia. When the Son of Man comes, keep going.
In his glory and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And he will set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on his right hand, "Come, you blessed of my father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me." Then the righteous will answer him, saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you?" And the king will answer and say to them, "Assuredly, I say to you, insomuch as you did it to one of the least of these my brethren, you did it to me." Then he will also say to those on the left hand, "Depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not take me in. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick, and in prison, and you did not visit me." Then they also will answer him, saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry, or thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister to you?" Then he will answer them, saying, "Assuredly, I say to you, insomuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me." And these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into eternal life.
Okay, so here's the great scene at the end of time. All the nations are gathered together. The whole world's gathered together. They're split into two groups, the sheep and the goats, on the right hand and on the left. And the final judgment takes place. Now, a lot of people are saying today in the world, we don't know who are sheep and who are goats. We don't know who the saved are and who the lost are. There's a problem with that theory because Jesus bases his final judgment on how you treated the sheep. And if we're going to be judged on how we treat the sheep, we better be able to recognize who the sheep are. Okay? So he gathers them together. And there's two things about this. Both the sheep and the goats, both the saved and lost, they're both surprised at what's happening, the turn of events. Those who get to go in, they have that good attitude that we've been reading about in what chapter? The proper attitude. What was that verse? Luke 17:10. What's it say? We're unprofitable servants. How do we get to go into heaven? They're just shocked. And he says, well, don't you know? You fed me, you clothed me, you visited me, you took me in. They say, when did we do that? That's not an attitude of meritorious works. These are people that did what was their duty to do, but they don't feel like they got anything that they deserve. And he's saying, when you did it to one of the least of these, my brother. He's worried about how you treat the church. And final judgment is based upon a relationship to the church. You better be able to recognize the church and find out who you should be helping out and working with. Shows up in final day judgment. On the other hand, the people who were turned away, they're kind of shocked too. But they have a completely different attitude. And they're wanting to know, how come we don't get to go in? He's saying, well, you didn't take me in. You didn't feed me. You didn't clothe me. They're like, well, when did we see you? No, we can't know who the Lord's people are. That's just impossible. And he's saying, nope, when you didn't do it to one of the least of these, my children, you didn't do it to me. Final day judgment. He says, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. You know what? We might would do it to one of the more important ones of those. We might be willing to take the preacher home for dinner or to have the preacher to our house, even though we don't keep many preachers in our homes anymore. We generally put them up at a hotel. But, you know, we would probably do it for someone great. If Paul showed up now, we'd put up Paul. But, you know, having one of just the ordinary members from church over during the week and having some hospital, nah. When one of the regular members of church gets like, nah, we're not going to go visit them. What's our obligation? He says, verse 46, and these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. This same word is translated everlasting and eternal. And he's saying it's the same either way. Hell is just as much forever as heaven is. People want to teach the annihilation of hell. Hell ends in annihilation or it's going to fizzle out. If hell fizzles out, heaven does too. It's tied together. A final picture, a final judgment. Clearly, clearly, this last section, verse 31 through verse 46, is talking about final day judgment. It's tied with all the other ones, all the other parables in 24 and 25, looking back to final day judgment. It's a package deal. There was a book written by one of our brethren entitled The Destruction of Jerusalem. And it did a good job of describing the historical events surrounding the destruction of Jerusalem. But the author taught that 24 and all of 25 talked about the destruction of Jerusalem. And that's pretty much the only book that most of our brethren have read about the destruction of Jerusalem. And so it's had a wide scope and it's also had a big impact, I believe, on our brethren. And they haven't stopped to consider the implications of what all that means. We've had other brethren amongst us who take the 80-70 position. They try to cram all of this in for the sake of making it all happen with the destruction of Jerusalem and that being the final day judgment. That don't work. There's problems in both areas, but I just want to make you aware of that. And I hope that you'll recognize the division in verse 36. This is a transition state, and that you'll remember if you get nothing else, you'll remember these three questions. When will these things be? The destruction of Jerusalem. What is the sign of your coming, the parousia? And what about the end of the world? The parousia and the end of the world come together, but it's something we're still waiting for. No man knows the day nor the hour. It's going to come quickly and suddenly. It's going to surprise a lot of people, even those within the church. Any questions or comments? We shut down. Any thoughts, Dad?
Well, I don't remember you reading this passage. It just kind of helps me a little bit when I'm explaining Matthew chapter 24. right quick. No worries. Hold on. I had it picked up here. Just a minute.
Verse 29. Sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, to me, a passage that helps there on that is Genesis chapter 37, I think it is, where Joseph had a dream and the sun and the moon and 11 stars bowed down to him. And